Coming up on Tech News Weekly, talking emoji with Emojipedia's Jeremy Burge in studio. Also, Mark Gurman talks about FBI versus Apple, part deux. Melissa Hellman shares all the ways that people are donning anti-surveillance gear. Some pretty interesting stuff there. Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey is spilling the beans about Edit and a whole lot more in a video that went up yesterday. And senators can't be trusted to stay off their damn phones. That's up next on Tech News Weekly. Tech News Weekly is brought to you from LastPass Studios. You're focused on security, but are your employees? LastPass can ensure that they are by making access and authentication seamless. Visit LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 116, recorded Thursday, January 16th, 2020.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV provides IT training that's effective and entertaining with access to virtual labs and practice tests. Visit itpro.tv/TNW for an additional 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription. Use code TNW30 at checkout. Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where we every week talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I'm Micah Sargent.
I'm Jason Howell, and holy cow, there's a third person sitting in the studio.
Right between us. How are you doing, Jeremy Burge, the chief emoji officer of Emojipedia?
Very good to be here. You just reminded me that I was going to come on last year when you had no power in the studio. So right. It's nice to be back with power in the studio.
Well, maybe there's power in the studio. There have been some technical difficulties this morning.
It's kind of similar, right? It's similar. Thankfully, it's not a fire.
Yes, there are no fires. Let's knock on this wood table that's definitely real wood. Welcome.
Thank you.
I know you are round about the town because you are part of the emoji subcommittee of the Unicode Consortium.
Yes, and the technical committee meets this week. So there's a lot of committees. It's kind of, you know, you get carried away. But nonetheless, the technical committee meets this week, and that's the one that makes, I guess, decides on whether the recommendations the emoji committee makes, whether they think they're good or bad.
So okay, are
committee
you...
Committee Palooza.
Yeah, the committee Palooza. Are you part of the technical committee? Are you part of both the technical committee and the emoji committee? How does that work?
Both. I'm part of both. What happens is that all the tech companies, Apple gets one vote, Microsoft gets a vote, Google gets a vote, Emojipedia gets half a vote.
Oh, nice. Who gets your other half?
Don't know. Nobody. We're a smaller member, so we get half a vote. So technically, if anything got contentious, we could vote to pro or con.
You could be the swing vote.
You're the swing half vote.
Kind, sort of.
I wish there was another half because each of you could wear half of an emoji heart or something, and then the other person would have it. And when our powers combine, we make a difference.
I do feel like without another half, we're a bit lost because obviously you need a minimum number of people to have quorum to mean that votes count.
Yeah.
And my half vote counts for nothing because you can never, the half, you know, you need round numbers. So we do need Twit or someone to come on board and become another half member.
Come on now. All Leo, emojis in my heart. So I want to start, actually. I think that to this day, there's still a lot of people who go, Apple put this emoji on my phone and I want this new emoji. Or more likely now these days, they tweet at you and say, hey, I don't like this emoji, or hey, I want this emoji. Who is in charge of emoji? How do they come about? Who makes these decisions?
Unicode effectively make the decisions, but they're still like, it is confusing, right? So like what happened in 2019 is that Google put out a statement to say, hey, look, there's all these emojis that are meant to be gender neutral, but no one's showing them like this. Mm-hmm. So we, Google, are just going to take it on ourselves to redesign our own, which they can do, and do this. But then it's sort of on Unicode to go, well, now there's a bunch that aren't gender neutral as well. So Unicode then has to get involved to try and standardize it a bit. Then Apple got on board to sort of say, oh yeah, we're going to go for it. We're going to put out a whole bunch of them in our new update. So we really need this, a new emoji release sort of ahead of schedule. So it's a mix, right? It's Unicode mostly, but there is some control that the companies have.
Okay. So it is a little bit, it makes a little bit of sense to go, oh, Apple, you know, I want this emoji, but
at the end of the day, the ruling does fall to the committee.
Unicode, especially if you want a new one. If you don't like the design of one, though, then you're probably going, hey, Apple or hey, Google or whoever's design you don't like, right?
Gotcha.
People kind of get up in arms about what the dog looks like or what the toppings on the pizza, whatever. And that's just a choice of the companies, although they do more and more try and work together.
The design like can be interpreted in different ways or whatever, even though it's the same thing. It's still a dog, but maybe the dog has a look on its face.
Yeah.
It's like disgruntled dog. And that's not the point. It's a dog.
I just want a dog, not a disgruntled dog.
Anyone who follows it for a while, though, might have noticed that more and more vendors are closer together, and there is a bit more of a push in recent years that in the past Unicode sort of go, not our problem.
Right. We've approved this. We've done our part.
And it's up to you all what you do, whereas more and more now there is sort of a bit more of an idea that maybe for emoji it should be that companies go, look, we really do need to try and roughly have these looking the same.
Sure.
So that's happening. Look out for that more this year and next year.
Yeah, right, and that's because I don't want to have the problem where with my few and far between, like Aunt Pruitt is one of my only Android friends. Jason, I guess you count too.
You just got defriended live.
Sorry, Jason. See, I forgot you were Android there for a second. All about Android guy. Anyway, that's awkward. Retake. No, I'm kidding. We're doing it live. I send an emoji, and then if Google chooses a different design for it, then when I was sending a joke, he could interpret it as, well, I don't want to be your friend anymore. And that's a problem.
Yeah, and it's a problem for the tech companies, too, that if they have to redesign, if you're Google and Apple has one design, you have a different design, you might sort it differently, you might put the smileys in a different order, depending on how happy they are.
Yeah.
And then if you decide, if everyone says, oh, we really want it to look like Apple's one, if you're Google, you might then have to move it on the keyboard, change the look. Anyone who used it before is annoyed at you that they don't have that anymore. It is a mess. It does help if they look roughly the same to begin with.
Yeah, so let's talk about the sort of the difference between going back to 2018. What all happened in 2019? So from 2018 to 2019, 2019, I remember lots of emoji updates. And I don't know if that was just because people were paying more attention to those emoji updates more than I've ever seen, or if it was genuinely that we got a lot of different things changing in emoji. But certainly 2019 brought a lot of fun and complicated stuff, especially with all of the different options that we have now.
You're right. Lots of things happened in 2019. There was the normal update in March, which added 230 emojis. Big categories there were the accessibility set from Apple. There was, the usual set of sort of objects and smileys and the like. There was the pinching hand and that sort of thing. There was a yawning face, but in addition, there were the different skin tones for the people holding hands.
Oh, yeah.
Apple has a really good picker on that. Google's one, you push and hold the people holding hands now, and you get a grid of about 25, a black and a white person, a white and a black man, woman, two
women. Is that intuitive enough for most people?
I think it's fine for 25, but if it's scaled any more, Apple's one where you pick them individually is kind of maybe a bit cleaner. It might scale more if you had more people or if it happens to more
emojis. Does the consortium have any say as far as how that sort of thing is implemented, how these things are surfaced?
It's sort of considered. There is an emoji documentation that this week an update was approved vaguely, which it sort of makes guidelines, recommendations to say it has something from 5 years ago, the original skin tone, saying vendors should do something like push and hold on an emoji to get skin tones.
All right. It's a little bit of standardization around that, but it's not a requirement.
Exactly. Yeah. Then what happened that was interesting last year is there was the usual set in March, but then a whole different set that happened later in the year in October, which added a whole bunch of extra gender neutral options and more holding hands people. A few were cut from the original set going, there's just too many. And then I think there was a push to just go, no, we're going to have everything have a gender neutral option and everything have a hand holding option. So they were added later in the year.
Right. All right. So now I'm looking on emojipedia.org and I'm seeing a preview of some of the draft emoji candidates that are going to come out in 2020. Is that a milkshake or a coffee, or what am I looking at there?
In 2020, yes, the Emoji 13 list there, that's some of the drafts that probably will be approved this year. What you're looking at, I'm looking over your shoulder here, is a bubble tea. Boba tea?
Bubble tea.
Oh, yeah.
Getting so specific.
Depending on where you are. popular. People like it.
Yeah,
there's there's a seal. There's
the baby seal or a seal. I wanted to say like
not
baby
defined
seal.
The
yeah.
age.
Okay, all right, undefined. Okay.
Italian hand. A bit of this.
Oh yeah, a little bit of this and a little bit of that.
You can put
you can use that for like a chef's kiss.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, you can put it here, wherever you like. A slightly contentious one might be there's a pickup truck that Ford proposed but kind of didn't tell anyone it was them. So which
oh,
is
really?
You're
sneaky.
Legally allowed to.
But wait, there's no pickup truck in Emoji.
There's
currently?
No current pickup
every
truck.
Once in a while like this happens where yeah. I'm like, how did that not make it in there? Like
sometimes there's no legit proposal, so that yep. came through the proposal. Don't get me wrong, it needs to stand on its own grounds no matter who proposes it. But
right,
then
sure.
Ford later did a whole sort of campaign
of
be
course.
Like, look how cheeky we were. It was us that did this.
We and got the pickup truck in there, and so then it becomes the Ford Emoji pickup truck.
I saw some people point out, I'm not a car guy, so I wouldn't know, but they pointed out a few design things in their proposal.
Oh, well, you got it Ford wrong around like, the hubcap.
It's sort of like the Ford proposal had like a slight thing around the window trim, so Unico will be careful to not put those on the specs.
Okay. Oh, I'm glad someone came along and said, no, don't do that. That'll make it an actual Ford. That's smart.
Yeah, so that would be the key. Right. It's like, it's fine for them to do that, but you don't want the actual spec to have to be one type of pickup
yes.
truck.
Okay.
Now, I've read in the past that one of the things that whenever the committee meets, and I think this is just the subcommittee, not the technical committee, but I could be wrong. I don't remember which one it is. But when they meet, they talk about what comes after Unicode. What can happen after Unicode if they were to let go sort of Emoji and let go and let God, let it exist on its own, and some of the technologies that are available there. Is that something that they still talk about, or are they kind of back in the, okay, no, we've got to take control of this, make sure it stays?
It comes up a bit as a topic, like the whole idea of, not quite how dare, but like, why do we have one committee on Earth that decides what the emojis can be? Like, it makes sense mm-hmm. that it wouldn't be everyone's favorite idea. If you don't have an emoji you want, or if Unicode declines your character, sometimes they're quite Western because they're Western sort of US companies mostly. There is a proposal from the current president of Unicode that suggests having, it's called QID emoji. It's kind of like an open emoji proposal where anything with a Wikipedia page could have its own emoji.
Hmm.
It uses QID is the code that Wikipedia pages all have. It's like the unique ID of a Wikipedia page. It would still be up to vendors if they wanted to support them, but it means that hypothetically, if we listed every type of dessert or every dog breed or whatever, you've got a unique thing to link back to say, hey, that it's this ID of dog breed or it's this ID of dessert or whatever it is. And then if different vendors wanted to support them at different times, when they converge, they've at least got the same ID. There's something to go on to say this is that. It's not clear if this is going to go ahead. There's sort of ongoing discussions. There's a public approval process right now where people can submit feedback. If you Google QID emoji feedback, you can probably, it'll come up somewhere. People can submit their feedback to say whether they think it's a good or a bad idea. But that would be that's one option that if Unicode were to let go a little, that would let companies do their own thing.
So then in theory, I just click the random article button on Wikipedia. Alucita tridentata, which is a moth of the family Alucitidae. That could have its, thank you. Perfect pronunciation. That could have its own emoji.
Absolutely. Especially, I mean, the idea would be maybe not for Apple, Google, big vendors, but maybe you have a certain app or just something that really wants to support a niche range of characters. Right now, Unicode says that's too specific for us. You should just use private use characters, which will only work in your app. Or you should use stickers or images. But this would sort of allow them to say, yeah, we could use this tag and code it correctly. And if it was ever sent to another platform in future that also decided to add the moth or whatever you had, the Andalucia moth, then your iPhone or whatever else supported that in future.
And that image would be coming from Wikipedia? Or?
No, right. It would come from the platform itself still. So the
because,
platform,
I mean, you're talking, I mean, I don't know how many entries on Wikipedia, but...
Yeah, there'd be lots of question
millions,
marks.
Millions. I have to imagine somewhere in the millions of images that a company might, you know, worst case scenario, be expected to create. That
I think the idea would
undoable.
Be, yeah, if you're a company, you might just want to add 20 things,
right,
and you put it in your font like you do today. It only works on your platform.
Specific.
Yeah.
Well, the Apple icon that I don't know that it counts as emoji. It's more in the other side of things, the symbol,
the logo,
the Apple logo. That can show up as something else on different platforms.
That is private use.
Yeah, private use spot.
So
in
that's
Unicode.
A perfect example. That couldn't be an emoji because you can't have copyrighted logos as emoji. It isn't meant to be interchanged because it's meant to be only used on one platform, but you can't help it if people share it.
Right.
By using, in theory, this QID emoji, there would be an entry for Apple logo on Wikipedia, and then every platform, if they wanted to support it, they could.
Gotcha.
It's still a bit messy. It still needs someone, maybe Unicode, defining what the most popular ones are or saying, hey, the major platforms recommend these. It could be the same thing, but it does let someone, if they really need an extensive set, they could go off the deep end and do hundreds or thousands
right.
on their platform or app.
I've got two remaining questions for you, and then we will have to stop. But the first one is, what are we looking forward to this year, 2020? What I mean, I know you've been chatting and biking and doing lots of stuff. You're here, obviously. So what are we looking forward to in this coming year?
This year and next year, I mean, some of the drafts are things like the Italian hand. That's potentially this year. even the future years, Unicode's already looking at next year as well, which okay. is extra things like there's some, the couple that have a little heart between them, they still don't support mixed skin tones. There's a proposal for that. There's the handshake that also doesn't support skin tones. That could be a next year thing. And there's a few more gender related things. So things like right now, there's the tuxedo. It's sort of, there was an idea a few years ago to say, well, look, there's a woman, there's a bride, so we should add a man with tuxedo. And it was kind of, I guess, a bit short-term thinking, like that now there's one man who wears a tuxedo, but there's not a woman in a tuxedo.
Right.
So there's ongoing work. There's only about 10 left. There's the dancers, the royal family, the prince and princess, Father Christmas. There's a look at maybe a gender-neutral Santa. Just really evening it out, kind of having three of nearly everything. Nearly, it was all done for the most part last year, but there's a few odds and ends to tie up, and that will be up to Unicode and vendors to decide, like, exactly what are we going to do about all these.
Gotcha. And then the last question that I have for you is, if someone wants to submit a proposal for an emoji, where do they go to get that process started? And can you name just some of the things they have to consider in submitting an emoji proposal?
If you Google Unicode emoji proposal, it will come up. There's also some information on Emojipedia, which has a few links to help people out. There's been blog posts that people have written. Unicode have what they call their selection factors for emoji. Mostly they're things like, are they going to be popular? It's contentious trying to say how popular something would be. There's been work last year. Unicode released some stats on emoji usage. It showed that smileys were high, hearts were high. We already kind of knew that. Flowers came up quite high, which actually gives a bit of a bump. If you were now proposing a new flower, you could point to Unicode stats.
Gotcha.
And go, look, flowers are quite
popular.
Now's
the time. Strike.
Or, yeah. Celebratory.
Strike while the flower's hot.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what you'd want to do. You want to prove it's popular, which is hard to do, that it's visually distinctive. So it, while you don't have to be a professional designer, it helps if you can prove that people can identify it at a small size and that it's not copyrighted. It's not copyrighted. So yeah, flowers and celebratory things like celebrations, so popular. So if you got that, it's got a much higher chance of getting in than a new bit of furniture around your house, which turned out not to be that popular.
Right. Okay. Wow. Well, Jeremy Burge, thank you so, so, so much for joining us here today. Of course, Chief Emoji Officer at Emojipedia.org. If folks want to follow you online and check out your work, where can they do so?
Twitter and Instagram at Jeremy Burge. Twitter for the emoji stuff. Instagram if you want to follow me on my boat.
Yes, that's right. You're on a boat.
Yeah, so we could talk about boat tech sometime as well. There's a lot of technology on the boats, but for now, we'll do the emoji stuff.
Emoji for now, boats for later, definitely. Well, thank you. Thank you for joining
us. Yeah, thank you, Jeremy.
Good to be here.
It was fun.
All right, there's an iPhone. It's encrypted. The FBI wants access. Stop me if you've heard this before. Apple and the FBI are back in the news, this time for an iPhone reportedly belonging to the alleged Pensacola shooter. More on that in a moment, but first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by IT Pro TV. You can kick off 2020 by accelerating your career or getting your IT team certified. IT Pro TV's edutainers blend education and entertainment to make learning IT engaging and fun. You will get the most out of your learning with practice tests and hands-on learning. Prepare for tough certification examinations with practice questions. Take and retake tests to ensure you're ready before you sit for the exam. And try out your skills on virtual machine labs with multiple instances of Windows Server and desktop clients on your macOS, Linux, iOS device, and Windows platform. Explore the different IT career paths that IT Pro TV can help you reach. There's entry-level IT, there's systems administration, there's desktop support, there's cloud technology, and so much more. Premium members can take advantage of their one-on-one learning coach services should you need a little extra guidance. They are the official video training partner for CompTIA and have 12 CompTIA on-demand courses, including CompTIA A+, Network Plus, and Security Plus certs. Become part of IT Pro TV's family with either a standard membership with video only or a premium membership, which includes both video plus labs and practice tests. Grow your career at itpro.tv/TNW and use code TNW30 to receive 30% off. That's itpro.tv/TNW and use code TNW30 for an additional 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription. IT Pro TV, build or expand your IT career and enjoy the journey.
So Apple and the FBI are at it again. First, it was the San Bernardino case back in 2016 where the FBI pushed Apple to open, or tried to anyways, to open the iPhone of a mass shooter. In that case, Apple was ultimately let off the hook when a private company helped the FBI to break in without Apple's help. But we all knew the battle over encryption wasn't over. We continue to hear about it, and here we are again. A similar story has emerged. A gunman's iPhone in Pensacola, Florida, is now at the center of a dispute between the Justice Department and Apple to open things up once again. Here we are. Joining us to talk about what this means for Apple and encryption at large is Mark Gurman from Bloomberg. It's great to get you back, Mark. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit, starting off, about the specifics behind this shooting in Pensacola and maybe what the Justice Department kind of expects to find on the gunman's phone, if we even know the answer to that question at this point.
Yeah, there was a shooting at a naval base in, like you said, Pensacola, Florida, at the end of 2019. And what the Justice Department wants is to be able to get into that phone, maybe to see data that they don't think is accessible via cloud backup. One example could be iMessages, right? You can get the messages in the backup, but they're encrypted, so they're not readable. So that could be something that they're looking to get. There's other information like location data that could be stored on the phone itself that's not stored in the cloud. It's very possible that the user, you know, turned off iCloud backup for some specific features. But at the end of the day, I mean, as the story you're showing on the screen right now indicates, you know, they don't really need Apple to get that phone unlocked. There's plenty of third-party solutions in order to do this.
So, so one of my questions has to do with that. I mean, obviously, with, you know, as each new iPhone comes out, Apple creates these devices. I would imagine, you know, they would like to believe that they're creating them more and more secure with every iteration. Is there a difference between the devices that they were looking at 3 years ago and the security model around those devices versus what they're looking at now? Is it the case that Apple just really is hamstrung and couldn't possibly get the data off if they wanted to? Or there's a will, there's eventually a way?
Yeah, I mean, 3 years ago with the San Bernardino situation, we were still more in the infant stages of this type of situation of encryption and third parties being able to break into these phones. But nowadays, it is so plentiful, the amount of companies and contractors and people who are able to get into these things without Apple building a back door. I mean, the iPhone 5 and the iPhone 7, those are two of the devices that the Florida shooter terrorist had, and those are older phones. At this point, it's extremely rudimentary to get into them. I mean, one person I spoke to who does this type of stuff, so they can get into the phone in under an hour if they had a 4 to 6 digit PIN code. So this is very simple stuff. I personally find it very likely that, you know, the government could have already gotten into the phone if they tried, and who knows if that already happened, right? But it seems like this is a political power play where they want Apple to sort of build that back door, so it'll be easier for the government to get into these devices moving forward.
Yeah, and that kind of ties in with one of my curiosities about this too. I mean, the political landscape is definitely different in many ways from what it was back in 2016. However, the struggle is still there to gain access or to change things around encryption. But the heat is much more on, from the government's, the U.S. government's perspective, to do away with encryption. So is this less, would you say, about Apple opening things up and more about making an increased case that encryption for individuals, let's say, needs to not happen anymore? And do you think this is going to go far in kind of furthering that approach?
Yeah, I think it's a mix of things. I think it's more so the government wanting to break encryption in the way where they have the backdoor from the manufacturers. I don't think they necessarily want or are pushing for the companies to get rid of encryption. They just want a password to get past that encryption, right? They have no problem me encrypting my phone so someone who, you know, finds it on the street can't open it. But they, the government themselves, they want to be able to open it. Obviously, Apple creating that backdoor means that this type of technology can get into the hands of bad actors. At the same time, bad actors already have this technology versus companies like, you know, Graylink and Cellebrite, where these things are pretty plentiful already. So it's a very interesting circumstance because I think on both sides, there's the opportunity to, you know, move to the middle a little bit more.
Yeah, totally. Now, you've mentioned a couple of times Cellebrite. Is it Grayshift or Graylink?
I think I said Graylink, but Grayshift.
Just wanted to be sure. Yeah, Cellebrite, Grayshift. I've heard a good amount about Cellebrite. I'm not as familiar about Grayshift. Do they both operate pretty similarly? They're just basically very tuned into whatever the vulnerabilities might be on any model of, let's say, an iPhone, for instance, and that allows them to kind of market that and sell that to people who are interested in breaking devices. Is that how that works, or how does that work?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right, Jason. But there are two parts to this, right? So for Cellebrite, they basically offer two types of software. One is to actually get that phone open. It's to get past the passcode to unlock the phone. The second thing is to be able to analyze the data on the phone. And what Grayshift is able to do is they're able to get that phone unlocked. Cellebrite offers a tool to do that as well. But at the same time, you then need the analyzer on top of that, and Cellebrite offers that analyzer. And, you know, the tool to get into the phone itself is called Cellebrite Premium. It's like $100,000-$150,000 to get that. And then the solution to actually analyze the data is about $15,000 up front, and then about $4,400 a year is in terms of a annual subscription maintenance fee.
Hmm. Okay. Oh, you know, so a couple bucks, not too bad. In-app purchase. It's about as much as some toddlers rank up on those little games that they play. So my question for you, are we seeing a repeat of the playbook that Apple used in the past with this new round of Apple versus FBI, or does Apple have some new tactics in the works this time? How is Apple kind of combating this? And again, are we looking at history repeating itself sort of on both sides here?
Yeah, Micah, to your point, I think it's going to be the exact same playbook. I'm seeing the exact same strategies. I'm seeing them say the exact same things. This is the same thing all over again. But I don't think this is blown up in the same way that the San Bernardino shooting blew up back in 2015, 2016, right? That was a much more pressing issue at the time because that was really the first time we were having this debate. I think the company, the government, and consumers are sort of used to it by now. The San Bernardino thing was a really big deal. Everyone knew about that. So I think this time around, it's a little bit more muted. And I kind of, so far, you know, see it kind of dying out. I think the government is going to go into the corner and get this thing done. You saw Trump try to escalate this on Twitter. But we're at the point where, you know, President Trump tweets so many things where putting out a tweet saying that Apple should unlock the phone doesn't really have as much meaning as if it was a previous president who doesn't speak as much, right? It was kind of interesting. Like, you would think the president tweeting that Apple should unlock the phone would be a really, really big deal. But there's so much other stuff going on in the government. There's so much other stuff being tweeted where it kind of just doesn't matter or make as much of an impact as it would have been in previous administrations. So, you know, that might be considered an escalation, but it really didn't do anything.
Right. Yeah. Gets lost in the noise. Year 2020. Right. Now, Tim Cook has asked that Congress pass a law that defines the boundaries between public safety and security, largely for cases such as this. And, you know, we can understand why he wants that definition. Are we, like, in the way that politics are working right now the last couple of years, in the shadow of the San Bernardino case, are we any closer to that happening? Has there been any movement in that regard?
Yeah, you know, I think we're at a point where this situation is quite a bit different than the San Bernardino shooting in that it's already happened before. Yeah. But I think that, you know, the constant meetings with the government that Apple's having puts them more so on the good side of the situation. What I'm particularly interested in, not to veer topics, is what happens when you're on a phone that is not as easily breakable as the iPhone 5 and the iPhone 7, right? I saw some news the other day that, you know, Cellebrite or the government was able to get into an iPhone 11, but you know, to my knowledge, getting into an iPhone 11, the latest phone, is a lot more difficult than getting into an iPhone 5 or an iPhone 7, right? Just because of all the security enhancements that have had over they've done over the past few years. What happens if the iPhone 12, right, is even more encrypted and more secure, and the government just can't get into that, right? That's going to be the one to watch. When there's a time where the government can't get into the phones themselves. If you remember, the government was prepared to go to court with Apple. Apple's prepared to go to court with the government, right? And it's going to be a lot harder of a case for a lot of people if the phones aren't able to get into from a third party. So I think at this stage, you know, Cellebrite and Grayshift, those are blessings in disguise for Apple.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. Well, Mark Gurman, thank you so much for hopping on with us for a few minutes to talk about this. Mark Gurman, of course, writes for Bloomberg.com. You do excellent work there. If people want to follow your work online, where can they find you? Where should they find you?
Yeah, Twitter's fine. Twitter.com/Mark Gurman. I hope you guys like, you know, NBA takes. So there's a mix of those in there, too. I actually got really destroyed on Twitter for a take this morning on the NBA, but, you know, whatever.
Right on. Well, I appreciate you mixing it up a little bit. Everybody can check that out. Thank you so much, Mark. Have a wonderful
day. Take care, guys. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks.
Bye. Take care.
All righty. Well, I've got cameras on me. And you've got cameras on you?
I suppose so. My smartphone.
Right? Yeah, yeah. But their cameras always focused on us. But unfortunately,
and we have a bunch of studio cameras pointed at us. That's, I think, where you were going.
They're everywhere.
What? My smartphone has cameras.
Yes, like, I was meanwhile, talking there's about cameras these everywhere. Cameras. Come yeah. on. And I'm not wearing tech to keep me shielded from it.
Oh.
But increasingly, people are wearing tech to remain anonymous in, as we call it, the age of surveillance. Bum, bum, bum. Here to talk to us about the age of surveillance and how people are protecting themselves is Melissa Hellman of the Seattle Times. Welcome, Melissa.
Hi, Micah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us today. So let's kick things off. I think that there was a time where when I would see this kind of technology being shown, it was typically in like fashion magazines and like Dwell magazine and strange sort of more artistic places. But I think as we go on, this is becoming less of a sort of a fringe trend. And so I'm curious, you know, in your reporting on this, are you seeing an increase in folks sort of looking to this technology, understanding where we are in the terms of surveillance and trying to find ways to remain anonymous?
It does seem like it's in the zeitgeist right now for a lot of people to be testing out these different anti-surveillance gear. It seems like especially since around 2013, since the revelations of Edward Snowden, that there has been a spike in usage of anti-surveillance gear.
For sure, for sure. And can you talk a little bit about like what is out there right now? What are people doing? Are we looking at permanent body modifications like tattoos that obscure your face or, I don't know, implants? Or are we talking about things that people can just sort of augment temporarily to protect themselves?
I couldn't find anyone who was actually tattooing their faces to try to do this, to try to obscure themselves in surveillance systems. But what I saw was a lot of makeup. I saw face paint. There's even been some research to show that Juggalos, so they're the diehard fans of the hip hop duo, and St. Clown Posse, that they actually their characteristic face paint, which is black and white, that looks like a clown. It's able to somehow thwart facial recognition systems.
Wow.
And then there's also some designers who are creating face paints with different designs. And then there's some more subtle measures like the reflecticles, which I profiled in my most recent story from the Seattle Times. And so the reflecticles have a special wavelength absorbers that are baked into the lenses. And so they're able to actually soak in the infrared light. So it's able to thwart facial recognition systems that use infrared light.
And that's what we're looking at in this photo right here, right? Someone's wearing the reflecticles. And
right.
So one of my questions about this was, it like, there's, you know, on one hand, you could obscure your eyes because there is actually iris detection and that sort of stuff. And you wouldn't want someone to see the details in your eyes. So maybe you'd want to obscure your eyes. These actually, I mean, based on that photo, obscure your entire face, it almost seems like, on some of these cameras. Is that how it's designed to work?
Yeah, so I think for some cameras, you just appear as this big white blob.
Wow.
But it's generally just designed to obscure your eyes, and your eyes are a key component for facial recognition systems because the mapping needs to see your eyes. So it's not necessarily designed to make your entire head disappear, but yeah, it does seem like with some surveillance cameras that that's the result.
Yeah, one of the things that you profile too is this adversarial fashion site and movement and brand. And one of the things that I've noticed with this is this doesn't have to be sort of the, as I said, the Dwell magazine and all the other sort of high fashion looks and designs. I would wear every single one of these outfits that's on this site.
I mean, it looks good.
It's really nice stuff.
I like it.
And so for folks who are coming to this new, essentially they've created different, they look like license plates, and it tricks license plate cameras into reading this and sort of adding junk data to the system. And that, I think, is the difference between what was once a fringe movement to now becoming something that, you know, everybody kind of can be a part of. What's interesting to me, and I'm curious about your sort of feel about this, is at the same time that we're paying more attention to the surveillance capitalism, as it were, the increase of this technology, like the Washington Post investigation with the FBI and the Customs Enforcement and Immigration, we also are, on the whole, adding more and more personal cameras to our lives. And there seems to be sort of a disconnect there. Are you noticing that as well?
Yeah, it does. It does seem like one of the researchers who I spoke with at ITIF told me that there is a spike in this anti-surveillance gear, that there are still a lot more people who have their own surveillance systems, such as Amazon's Ring, that they're using to monitor their properties. I recently did a story about a surveillance system that's at the entrance of a more affluent neighborhood here in Seattle, so that the neighbors are able to track whoever enters and leaves the neighborhood. So I think that's becoming more and more common. So I think we do see some people who are trying to protect themselves, but at the same time, I think that there's just so many other instances of surveillance all around us that it almost just seems like it's more of a statement than anything else. But there are some examples of people doing this to protect their own safety. The designer at Reflecticles, Scott Urban, he told me that there's been a spike in purchases from Hong Kong recently because there's a lot of protests that are going on there between the pro-democracy protesters and then the Hong Kong police. So they're wanting to have something to obscure their identity so that they won't be attacked or possibly be investigated.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, one question about this is kind of this like fuzzy line between, let's say, giving citizens the tools to protect themselves in this kind of new age of data harvesting and, you know, just, I mean, data hungry, you know, tech companies everywhere, and we're, you know, people are trying to protect themselves from this because they don't want to be sharing this data about themselves, their identity, that sort of stuff. So giving citizens the tools in order to do that, to protect themselves, and on the other side of that line, kind of giving criminals the tools to be better criminals, right? To kind of get away with what they're doing, that's easier. I don't know what my question is around that, but I think that that's the challenge that we find ourselves in right now, because I would want citizens to have the ability to have these tools to protect themselves. At the same time, you know, it's kind of similar to encryption, right? Like our previous topic. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it definitely does enable kind of criminals to be better criminals. And that's a tricky place to be in. I don't know where that lands as we go out into the future. What do you think about that?
Right. Yeah, I think that there are some people who are misusing these tools, or they're using them to commit crimes. And I think that hyper-realistic masks are becoming more and more common because they are more accessible. You can buy a very hyper-realistic mask for, I think, around $1,000, which
is so weird looking. Those are so creepy looking.
It is. And it really totally transforms your appearance. So there's been examples of notorious bank robbers within the past decade who have used these hyper-realistic masks to foil the police so that they wouldn't be able to track them down during investigations. And this is really bought them time because the police were looking for someone who didn't look like them at all. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm going to have to be in the market for it. No, I'm just kidding.
I just kind of want to get a hyper-realistic mask because they're so weird looking.
Yeah, that's really my curiosity there. You could get one that looks like me. I'll get one that looks like you. Oh, really?
I would love that. And then at the end of the episode, you can just pull it off.
Yeah,
that's right.
Oh, it was actually.
You had no idea. I was Jason all along.
We'll wear some reflecticles too.
Yeah.
Melissa Hellman, thank you so much, for doing this research. We appreciate that. And this is a great article that you should all go check out. If folks want to follow you online and check out future work of yours, how can they do so?
So they can look at my work at Seattle Times. So I'm currently doing a project called The AI Age, and it's a year-long project that's looking at artificial intelligence, and it's going to be done in a couple of months. So you can continue following my work for the next couple of months. You can also follow me on Twitter at @M_Hellman.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa. This was a lot of fun. We'll talk to you soon. Best of
luck. Thanks. Bye.
All right. It's story of the week time.
Story of the week.
Apparently, we were both circling the same one here.
Like vultures.
Yes. And I got there first. Wired has recorded a Q&A with CEO of Twitter, Jack Dorsey.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a sit down where Jack, it's just Jack on the camera, and he's answering kind of questions from just random Twitter users, basically, about the service. And, it's not like this hasn't happened before. It's not like he hasn't gone on the record on some of the topics here.
Right.
But it was kind of interesting to hear some of his answers on some of these questions. Some of the things that jumped out for me. Where do you stand on edit in Twitter?
I am anti-edit.
Yeah, I'm kind of there. I'm there too.
I feel like that's a bad thing to say among some people, but yeah, I'm anti-edit.
I'm kind of like okay with the fact that there are spelling errors and all that.
I've never had an issue with deleting tweets. If I want a tweet to go away, it's my doggone Twitter account.
Yeah.
And I should be able to delete a tweet. I am unashamed about deleting tweets. Some people are like, oh no, I can never delete a tweet.
It's on the record. It's got to stay forever.
It's got to stay there. I'll just tweet out another tweet that has it fixed. No, if I don't want to tweet there, it's my stream and I'm going to get rid of it. I understand in the place of, if you are a news organization and you want to follow certain rules, like the company that I used to work for, Newsy, they will actually issue deleted tweets to say, hey, we deleted this tweet, here's why,
etc.
That's a journalistic organization that's trying to, but for me, if I write Pong instead of pot, and that was a bad example, who cares? If I write Pong,
you live in California
pot, right
now,
exactly,
it's okay.
Is it Pong, is it pot, who knows? Then I'm going to delete the tweet and fix it.
Yeah, totally. So, there are a lot of people who feel very passionately that there should be some sort of edit functionality. I've always felt like it kind of hinders the original kind of point and approach of Twitter. I'm happy with the fact that things are imperfect. I'm also happy that it kind of forces people to kind of not be able to rewrite history, that sort of thing.
Yes.
So anyways, Jack does mention, he had a question about that. He basically mentions that it will probably never, ever happen. Kind of said it pretty definitively. Said maybe the possibility of a time delay, which I could kind of understand that too, right? Like I tweet it out and I have 30 seconds to be like, oh, but even there he said, but in order to do that, like we're delaying the sending of this tweet. And
so
I don't know how
not,
we feel about that.
Right.
It's not ideal.
Because it's not
to be
Twitter's,
immediate.
Twitter's whole thing is
it's about now. It's about immediate.
Especially if you're doing like a live tweet of an event or something
like that.
So maybe, I could see 30 seconds after the tweet is sent, you can edit it.
or shoot, even 10 seconds. 10 seconds isn't that much of a delay, but I get, but almost every time I ever have a spelling error, I notice it like 2 seconds after I hit send.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Give me that ability, I'd be fine, but I'm also happy with it not being there.
You know what else people could do?
What?
They could slow down, read the tweet.
No.
And make
no,
sure.
Because that magic needs to go out now.
I am brilliant.
Sound.
It needs to get to the
send.
World.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
That's exactly what it is.
Someone asked for a spell check so that trending hashtags aren't misspelled, because I guess that happens a lot. You know, people hop on the train, but they misspell the trending. And I just thought this was interesting. Jack says their algorithm detects all those spelling errors and groups them all together with the appropriate hashtag.
Okay.
So they're kind of, so it kind of doesn't matter.
I didn't know that.
Even if you misspell it, it's going to be grouped in with the same hashtag. Or,
that's pretty
supposedly,
cool.
Supposedly, according to Jack. He confirms, this is interesting because I'd heard reports about this, he does meditate 2 hours per day. This is so not important. he does meditate 2 hours per day. He does not, as the question asked, spend 52 minutes every day doing sauna and ice baths. and the question asked, I heard that you only eat 5 meals per week. And he was like, well, that's not true. I eat 7 meals per week.
He only eats seven meals?
He only eats dinner. What kind of monster only eats dinner?
I hope he eats a lot for dinner.
All right. It's so not important, but I just thought that was weird. That's, and finally, how do you get verified? Are you verified?
I am.
You are?
Yeah.
I'm not verified.
You're not?
I've never been verified.
Come on.
Megan's verified. I'm not verified. What's going on here? Anyways, Jack said to contact at KAYVZ for verification. That's Kayvon Bay. Is it Bay? Who is the co-founder of Periscope, currently head of product at Twitter. I think he was trolling.
Yeah, that's
sounds
really
like he was
terrible.
Trolling.
That's
he's
not
like, yeah,
very nice.
Send all of your verification requests to that dude. And I think that dude, you know, ended up going out on Twitter immediately afterwards. Is like, by the way,
I can't
do nothing. So I don't think you have any recourse if you're like me and you aren't verified.
Well, so I was verified in the time when Twitter was in love with journalists.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And so there was a period of time where Twitter was like, we love our journalists, because still to this day, a lot of what Twitter is journalists.
Yes. But oh, yes.
At the time, they were very much in love with their journalists. And so I was part of a news organization, Newsy.
Yeah.
And
that's probably part of it.
That's what it was.
Right there, yeah.
In fact, Twitter sent a message and said, hey, give us the at handles of all of your on-air journalists.
Yeah, they were doing
and
that.
We'll verify
right.
you. And
well,
so that's how I got verified. I did not have anywhere near the follower count that I have now. I still don't have a large follower count. So it's kind of silly that I do have that. But if you're listening, Twitter, do not take it away. I love my blue check.
I think they take that away. I think you're okay.
Yeah.
But if you're listening,
Add somebody.
Up.
Yeah.
The video is interesting. Some of it's pointless information, but I thought it was
fun. I think it's interesting. Yeah, I only eat 2 meals a week, so come at me, bro.
Which ones?
That's breakfast on Tuesday and lunch on a Saturday.
Man, if I'm eating 2 meals, like, in a given week, I am not wasting it on breakfast.
Oh, I
Heck
love breakfast.
No.
I
need breakfast, but I'm not wasting my 2 meals a week on breakfast.
Oh, okay, fine. So you're a dinner guy. Or are you a lunch guy?
Probably more of a dinner guy than a lunch guy. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. They're all, look, it's all food.
Look, he's
I
like,
need
I'm
it
not
to
trying
live.
To not
I need it to live, but if I had to choose, I'd probably choose dinner. Yeah.
If I could not eat, I've talked about this before. If I could just not eat, that's what I would do.
Yeah.
If there was a way for me to not have to think about eating.
Right.
But right
yeah,
now, my stomach is saying, you know what, Micah? How could you? How dare you not feed me? So if you hear anything that is not either of our voices, that is my stomach. Quite literally at this moment, it's growling.
Yeah. We'll stop talking about food.
Yeah, that's the problem. So let's talk about my story of the week, which is that adults have no self-control. Or adults can't be trusted to have self-control, just like kids. Nobody has self-control, folks.
Nope.
I don't care what you say. Unless you're Jack Dorsey, who only eats 5 meals a week, you cannot be trusted. During the impeachment trial for the current president, Donald J. Trump, Donald Johnson Trump, I don't know. During Trump's impeachment trial, senators can't be trusted to keep their eyes and their fingers off of Twitter and the rest of the internet. So they're actually going to have to turn in all of their devices before they enter the room where they're doing the proceedings. So they've got to leave their phones at the door. They've got to leave their laptops and their tablets at the door. Basically, everything needs to be left at the door. No electronic devices allowed. They're going to be stored in the, as they call it, the cloakroom. You're going to check your stuff at the door outside the proceedings in a special new cabinet that we've paid for.
A cabinet.
A new cabinet in the cabinet.
Okay.
That I'm sure we've paid for with taxes for that purpose. So there was somebody who, funnily enough, said, I just saw a piece of cabinetry in the cloakroom where we'll be required to turn over our iPads and our iPhones. So cool. They've got new cabinetry. But I think this is good.
I think I think it's good too, right? Like, especially on something this important.
Yeah.
Like, get off your phones. I'm wondering if they're taking a page out of the concert venues that are now implementing these pouches. Have you seen these?
Yeah.
Have you had to use one?
No.
I've had to use one once.
Oh, have you really?
Yeah. I think one of the companies is called Yonder, but they're these little mobile phone pouches with a lock that basically when you go into to see a band or whatever, or like a comedian. I think some comedians have done this. You have to put your phone in this pouch. It's locked, and you can gain access to it when you go back out. And then Robert Bigelow in chat.
Because I'm not saying, paying not for a dadgum Faraday cage built around the entire
Senate. Faraday cage. Yeah, exactly. So that's basically what it is. And this one in particular is called Yonder. I'm sure there are others, but yes, I've had to use it, and you got your little phone in your bag, and you can't get to it. Can't get to it.
I don't know how I feel about that.
I mean,
I get it, but in this case, I think there are two reasons why this is good. One, because we want everyone paying attention as much as possible, not playing Farmville. Yeah. Can you even play Farmville on the phone? I don't know. Well, you can't bring computers or laptops either, so you can't play Farmville. And then also because you don't, so I guess there's three, because the second thing is I don't want people sending out updates during this. I think mm-hmm. that this needs to be what it is, where it's taking place, how it's working. And then the third thing is to be swayed by external factors is not good. Mm-hmm. And so kind of like in court cases where the judge will say, no press, no, chats with anybody from the press, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
And we actually want you to stay away from the news as well so that you're not swayed by public opinion, etc. I think this is good. So
yeah
I think when folks can't be trusted to take care of these things for themselves, then you've got to implement a
standing order. Put your phone down.
Put your
Congress.
Phone down.
Put the phone down, Congress.
Stick it in this cabinet that's a Faraday cage.
You can have it later.
Yeah,
you can have your phone later and tweet
skater.
Out whatever it is you think is so important. I agree, Micah. And that is it for this episode of Tech News Weekly. This show publishes every Thursday at twit.tv/TNW. That is the place that you can go to subscribe, which is what you should do. Just go and subscribe. We've got audio. We've got video formats.
Soon
like Skittles.
We'll have.
We've got different types for everyone.
Lime.
Pick your favorite.
Lemon.
Fruit,
cherry.
Fruit punch.
Ew. Orange is the worst orange. Skittle. Ugh.
Orange, apple.
Apple is great.
Yeah.
Orange is the worst. Okay. Anyway.
Okay.
You can be a part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv with your favorite Skittle. My favorite in general are the mixed berry Skittles. I don't really eat Skittles anymore, but if I was going to, I'm going to eat mixed berry Skittles. You can also follow us on social media. Here we go. That's at Twit on Twitter. That's at twit.tv on Instagram. And that's at Twit Talk on TikTok. If you want to tweet at me, if you want to tweet at me, I'm Micah Sargent.
And I'm Jason Hill. Thanks to everyone who helps us do the show each and every week. Jeff, John. John, Jeff, Jeff, John, Jeff, John, Jeff, John. Basically, everybody that works here, their name starts with J.
And thank you to Jeremy Burge and
Jeremy.
Rachel for joining us in the studio this week. We appreciate that.
Yes, yes, yes. And thanks to you for watching. We wouldn't do this without you. We couldn't do
we
this
couldn't.
Without you. We'll see you next week
this
on
is very
Tech
true.
News Weekly.
Bye, everybody. Bye.